Our next talk will be held by Polaris, who's a German-based nerd and with a background in bioinformatics, and she has an interest in technology and society. She will be giving to us the talk about computing genomes and what this has to do with privacy. Please give a very big applause to Polaris.
Hi, hello, welcome everyone. It's nice that you're here at my talk on day four, very early in the morning. I appreciate that I had a lot to compete against, also against sleep and against the party yesterday. So yeah, let's get started. Just a short overview of what I'm going to do. I'm shortly going to introduce myself and why I'm motivated to do this. Then I will shortly go into kind of some terms. What is a genome? What are we talking about here? Then go on for into the technical part. How do we get a genome into a computer? Why do we get a genome into the computer? And then hopefully that part bridges over to why privacy matters in this. So as an introduction, hi, I'm Polaris. I study bioinformatics. And this year I organized a summer school and a lecture series on genomics, where we enable students to get their own genome sequenced and then do the analysis ourselves in the most privacy-friendly way that we could kind of manage. I also got my own genome sequenced and could see kind of my this also play out for myself personally, so that really motivated me to do this. This is kind of the motivation why I'm talking about this. I will not talk so much about the logistics and the details of the summer school. If you want to know more about that, come towards me afterwards. I'm happy to tell a bit more about that. And in this talk, I'll mostly kind of focus on the learnings that I got. On the one hand, technical, but also on the other hand, privacy-wise. So also, it's really important for me to say that this was not me alone. I had a lot of help. This really took a village to do. A couple of people I just want to really mention by name, because I think that really has to be acknowledged, are Vera and Alina, who really helped me so much with getting all this off the ground. Sandra, who was so important for data privacy. Anjan, Leon, and Marcel for the technical and like the theoretical basics. So let's get into it. What is a genome? First, kind of what a biologist might say about this. Here I brought you a nice cartoon. This is a cartoon of a cell. They don't really look like that, but it's helpful for us to visualize it like this. If we want to look for a genome, we're interested in all of the genomic information that is inside this cell. So we're looking into the purple stuff there, which is the cell nucleus, which has a lot of DNA, but also not forget the small red beans over there, which are the mitochondria, which also hold genomic information, which are part of the genome. Of course, for humans, this talk mainly focuses on human genomics. Other species are a whole different matter that I'm not going to talk about. So also what we should try to visualize, even though we have like this cartoon version, which looks nice and clean and ordered, the materiality of DNA is kind of goopy. This is kind of come back in later when we think about how we get this goop into a computer. Here you can also see kind of the result of an experiment where you extract DNA from strawberry. You can imagine it's kind of like the hello world of molecular biology. And so now, that was the biologist's perspective. I said before, I'm a bioinformaticist. Kind of what would my perspective be on this? For me, a genome kind of starts with this. I brought you another cartoon, this time of the molecular structure of DNA, which consists of like a molecule that's made from two strands, which intertwine, and we have the bases in between. You can kind of see them a little bit in blue. And we're really interested in the sequence of these molecules in there. So for bioinformaticists, this is what I want. Nice and ordered and discrete, and like all the letters are clear, and we have a clear sequence. But it does not end with that. Of course, we want the sequence, but also we want to find higher level information in that sequence. So we want to know how is that stuff structured? Where do we have genes? Where do we have non-coding areas? So after that, it would kind of look like this. This is what we kind of want. This is a visualization where you can see a little bit of the base sequence here. But what we actually want is like all the metadata. Here you can see this is LACC1. This is a genome that encodes for an enzyme called lactase, which helps to digest lactose sugar. You can see some metadata on it here. We are on chromosome 13. We are here in the chromosome. And down here, this is what we call an annotation. This is really what we want. We want to see, like, okay, this is part of the genome, but really the coding sequence starts here, and these are maybe some of the amino acids that it encodes for. So we start with like very low-level information, just like the letters, but then we want all of that kind of annotation and structuring and structure to see what's there. So then now comes the question, like, okay, that's nice to look at it with a computer, but like why? This is a technical why question. Of course, there's also the question of why should we do this at all? This is why to get the genome in the computer, part two, and we will come to that later. And first of all, now the question, like, why should we use computers to do this? Because genomes are huge, like really, really big. To kind of make this a bit more visual, let's look at an example. So the human genome is around 3.1 billion bases long. In scientific notation, that would be 3.1 times 10 to the power of 9. Still numbers, but doesn't really give an intuition, right? So let's look at it this way. The Hunger Games trilogy has 1.8 million letters, so all of these three books combined. And to get to like the length of a genome, we need these like 1,000 times. And trying to look for a specific gene in like a whole genome, which we don't know yet, is kind of in the same area of trying to find one wrong paragraph in like all these 2,000 editions of the Hunger Games trilogy. This is a lot of data. This is a lot of work. This is really something we want computers to do. Computers are pretty good, and the algorithms we develop for them are pretty good at finding information in like such a big magnitude of data space. So now, as we talked about why we use computers, let's talk about how. How do we get a genome into the computer? As I talked about before, DNA looks like this in the physical world, and we want it to look like this on our computer. This is a bit challenging, because what do I mean with like DNA is goopy? First of all, what I mean by that is that like it's like a long string of molecules. We're dealing with stuff in biochemistry. Molecules are like moving all the time. If we try to measure something in physical space, we can only measure in a margin of error. And like these molecules are really, really small. So we will have to contend with sequencing errors when we want to sequence DNA. And the second part of it is DNA is quite okay when it's inside your cells because it has a lot of molecular machinery around it that takes care of it, that does error correction and so. But it's not really temperature resistant. And outside of like a cell, it's not quite stable. So yeah, we have to contend with both of these. But the nice thing is we can solve one with the other. Because we have DNA sequencing like just of one strand might be prone to errors, we want to make many, many replicates of the DNA template that we have in the beginning. And we use this by exploiting the trait that is not very temperature resistant. I'm going to show you how. So this is our template strand in the beginning. If we heat it up, both of the strands will separate. This is what you see, like the orange one and the white one. And then we use an enzyme called DNA polymerase. That's like this little thing down there. And it's an enzyme that, if we give it extra nucleotides, can complement the strand that is like the single strand and create two full strands again. Now we have doubled the amount of DNA template that we had before. And we do this again, and we do this again, and we do this again. We heat it up, we replicate it, we heat it up, we replicate it. This is what you might have been heard as, this is the polymerase chain reaction, which is also used if we want to replicate other kinds of DNA, for example, in the context of like testing if there's like viral DNA in a sample, which I guess we all have been very familiar with in the last couple of years. I see a question there. Yes, exactly. That's what it means. Yes, the question was like, PCR test, does that refer to the polymerase chain reaction? Yes, that's exactly it. So, okay. So we have multiplied our template, but we still kind of need to measure something to get like a sequence into a computer. The method that I will outline here is called Illumina dye sequencing. It's one kind of DNA sequencing, but it's one I think that explains itself well to kind of give a intuition for the process. So what you see here is we have like a white single strand that is part of our template sequence. And you see in blue, again, this little circle is our DNA polymerase. And it complements the template strand with new kinds of nucleotides. That's like the blue ones. They're not any kinds of nucleotides, but they're nucleotides which can emit fluorescent light when they get built into the complement strand. And so because we have different kinds of bases in our DNA, which we would like to differentiate, each base has a different wavelength of light which it emits. And that then kind of looks like this. We build in our new base, in this case it's G. It gives off a specific wavelength. We move on, we have a T, it has a different wavelength. And light and wavelengths of light is something we can very well measure with the kinds of measuring devices that we have on hand. And so this is kind of the very nice process of how we turn goop into information onto our computers. Yet, we're not done with the computers. This process has a bit of a limitation of how long the reads can be that we can produce this way. Depending on the sequencing method that you use, we'll get around 75 to 150 base pairs long. This is not enough for our 3.1 billion base pair genome. So how do we do that? Before, I told you about this process where we replicate DNA, the template. That's part of a process called library preparation. And what also happens during library preparation is a fragmentation of our genome, or the template DNA that we want to sequence. And when we fragment something, it will not always break in the same kinds of way. So you can see that at the same positions, we have different kinds of reads overlapping with each other. And that's something that we can make use of. Because these are the kinds of reads that fall out of our Illumina sequencer. They're kind of short. And we also have no idea like in which order they are. We have no idea which of these is the first one. So we will use computers, and we will compare all of the reads to each other and see where they overlap and how much. That's very computationally intensive, so we mostly just use statistical heuristics to see, like, okay, which of these overlaps is most likely to be. And then we do that a couple of times. And hopefully, in the end, all of our reads together will produce a sequence or construct a sequence, which is the most likely sequence that all of these reads are made from. So this is really a task we want to use computers for because it's very intensive to compare all of the reads towards each other. But also a takeaway that I want you to take from this is that sequencing produces reads. We need a lot of compute to do this process, what I showed you, called mapping of the reads. And then we have a genome. But it's important to take away that this genome is algorithmically and statistically constructed. It's the best possible image that we have of the information that is in your cells, but we should never forget that it is an image of what is happening in your cells. It's not exactly the same thing because we have this measuring and this algorithmic construction process that happens in between. So, great. We got that. We now know how to get DNA goop and make a genome into a computer. Now is the second why question. Why should we do this? We certainly can, but should we? I would like to argue that genomic information can really help us a lot to know more about ourselves and to empower ourselves with this knowledge. I have a couple of examples of this. For example, this is another cartoon of an enzyme called lactase. We've seen the gene before. And if I have unspecified symptoms, if I'm going to doctors again and again, and they do not really find something with classical diagnostic methods, or, sadly, they might not believe me, or they might not take me seriously because I'm not white, or I might not be cisgender. And for that, if we have genomic information where we can ourselves kind of narrow down the diagnostic, but also get taken more seriously by medical professionals, I think that is a part of self-knowledge that can really empower us. Another example could be if I'm questioning whether the gender I identify with lines up with the gender I was assigned to at birth. A lot of genes can have an impact on that. For example, this is a cartoon of a protein that helps the body to detect testosterone and respond to it. There can be a mutation in that gene so that my body doesn't even respond to the testosterone that's present. That can, for one, help me maybe with self-knowledge, but also if I choose to take hormones, it could be very helpful to know that, okay, my body doesn't even respond to testosterone. I would have to take a different route maybe. But of course, both of these examples of either like medical symptoms or gender identity, these are genes that are very sensitive and they come to touch my identity and my life. And even though that might be helpful to me, what other people see as normal is highly normative and is not up to us as individuals to decide how other people might see us or judge us based on that information. What do I mean with more normative here? Normative means what power structures in the society construct as normal or as natural. Let's take another example for how that could play out. But first I'll take a sip of water because I'm a bit nervous. All right, so how could that play out? Let's imagine the following scenario. I got my genome sequenced, and I am really curious to know which of my genes might interact with infectious diseases. There might be genes that make me more prone to an infection with a certain pathogen. There might be gene variations that make me more resistant to a certain infection. So let's imagine I'm looking for that, and I find this. This is, again, another beautiful cartoon of a protein. That is produced by the gene CTFR, cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator. Ah, what a mouthful. Nice. So there is actually a mutation in this gene called Delta F508. What that means is there is one part in that gene where the sequence is different that produces a different kind of protein in the end, and that changes the function that it does. This gene in particular, and this protein, is very present in cells. Cells have a lot of content, which we've seen in the cartoon I've showed you before, but it also has a membrane around it, and it has to interact with its environment. And this gene, it makes a transporter that transports ions from inside the cell to outside. And that's really very important for on like a tissue level for different body fluids, and like their consistency. But so, let's return to this mutation, Delta F508. If I have the heterozygous mutation, which means I have one copy of the mutation and I have one copy of the gene that's not affected, this means I'm a heterozygous carrier. And it's theorized that because this kind of changes stuff at the surface of the cells, this makes it much harder for pathogens like Salmonella typhi, which causes typhoid fever, to enter the cell. And it's also theorized that in like an infection with cholera, it limits the fluid loss that I get, which is part of why cholera like is pathogenic or like what makes it hard to treat. So great, that's good. Like that makes me a bit more resistant to these two infections. Yet, I didn't tell you everything about CTFR. I mean, some of you might have noticed if you know cystic fibrosis in the name of this. I only talked about how what this affects if I'm a heterozygous carrier, so I only have one copy of this gene. If I have two copies of this gene, so if I'm homozygous about this, this means that like all of the transporters in the cells are affected, and this leads to a disease called cystic fibrosis, in which all of the body fluids are much thicker. And it's a disease that's on the one hand very connected with biological suffering. It makes it really hard to live, and it does it has an effect on lifespan. But it's also something which is connected to social suffering, because our society does not accommodate for people who have this condition. But yeah, let's imagine we came here from my interest in infectious disease, and I found out I have this. We're too far back. Let's go here. If I have children, I might pass on this gene. And this, if institutions that are not interested in protecting me or might even interested in exploiting me based on that information might have some very strong opinions on whether I should have children if I'm a carrier of this gene. And this is where normative power gets wielded. So that's how we came from what is normal is actually normative. And I hope that this example illustrates it well. And speaking about institutions that might have opinions or might make decisions on whether I can pass on these genes or not, if these genes should be around, I think on the one hand, in the face of rising fascism in Europe and other places, we should really fundamentally oppose ideas that connect human value and genes. But I think also we should practically make sure that our genetic data in the face of this is in our own hands and our own hard drives. So I hope this is how we get to privacy. As we've seen from the example I showed you, we can get very specific and detailed information on an individual genome, which is very specific and sensitive information about an individual. If we work with genomes as bioinformaticists, as people who work in genomics, this is knowledge that can be very empowering or disempowering. And that's really connected to who gets access to those genomes and who can use them. That is not a responsibility that we can get around. That is a responsibility that we have to live up to. That is not something we get to choose. This is the time we live in, and digital information comes just with these conditions applied, and we have to react to that, and we will have to find a position on that. And I think the only sensible position for this is to be privacy-friendly and privacy-preserving. So this is mostly informed by the learnings that I made from having my own genome and the genome of other people sequenced and analyzing them together in the frame of a summer school. So this is, in some ways, might be a bit more specific to that framing. But I hope you can still apply some of these also to other conditions in which you might want to sequence or work with genomic data. So first learning is that privacy is not just technical. Here I have identified four dimensions in which privacy really plays out if you want to do something like this. First of all, I guess, of course, it's technical. We tried to encrypt data whenever we could, whenever we stored them somewhere. We tried, enabled technical access restrictions, and of course, two-factor authentication. But more than that, it's really organizational. Privacy means just in the beginning that you care about privacy, and that like the genomic data that you work with does not get too other parties except the ones you know and that you directly interact with. It also means you only collect data when really necessary, and really separating genomic data and data about like who the person is, their identity, for example, through pseudonymization. And I think part of that is also really communicating transparently with the people that you work with. Communicate transparently with them what you're going to do and manage your expectations, that they cannot unlock everything through what you're finding in the genome. And of course, part of it is legal. I have had really good experiences with going to my local data privacy officer before we did any design decisions. And I can tell you, your local data privacy officer, they will be happy to not have to deal with an incident where people come to them after stuff has gone wrong, but before anything has happened. And design decisions can be actually can be shaped with them. And they also told me, like, I'm not going to tell you that you cannot do it at all. I'm just going to tell you cannot do it like this. And then through that constructive interplay, you can work to something. Of course, it also means getting familiar with the GDPR and what of those legal regulations apply to you. Of course, it's not just GDPR, but it might also be other laws. But let your data privacy officer be your guide to that. They will happily do that. And from that also deducts which responsibilities we have. And also, really important part of GDPR is consent. And it's not the kind of consent where you're just like, ooh, we have a data privacy consent form somewhere. You just have to like click here. But consent actually means being informed to make a decision. Give the people that you're working with the same information that you also would like to have to make your own decision on this. And also make it possible for people to participate, even if they do not consent. We set up the summer school explicitly so that if people decided they do not want to have their genome sequenced, they can still participate. We then worked with like data from the internet with people who had donated their DNA to kind of science and to the public. But yeah, in that way, I think privacy and taking consent seriously also makes this process accessible. And now, the fourth dimension of privacy is financial. It really, yeah. One thing that we did before we planned any of that is we consulted with people who had done it before. Those were two people who were teaching at a university in New York who had done like a whole summer course on anthropological genomics. And we asked them like, yeah, okay, where did you get the sequencing done? We would also like to do that. And they were like, oh, we just went to 23andMe, you know? Yeah. So in case you're not familiar, let me tell you a little bit about a company called 23andMe. It's a US American company that has been very big in the market of personal genomics. That means they sent little like kits to people where they could spit into a vial and they sent it back. And then this company deals with like the sequencing of the genetic material and then also makes the analysis and like sends you a report back of, I don't know, your dietary recommendations or which diseases you're prone to, or they also do ancestry analysis. Yet, let's look at the kind of track record this company has. In October of 2023, they had a huge data breach. 6.9 million people were affected, where names, health, and genome data got stolen by malicious actors. This was done, by the way, through an attack vector called password stuffing, where people reuse passwords from other sites. So the attackers looked for other breaches and see which passwords are connected with which email addresses, and then just tried if it also works for 23andMe. This is to say, this is not to blame on the users who do this. This should also be if you as a company take IT security seriously, you especially if you work with genomic data, you use two-factor authentication. You really have to. And also like other measures, but I'm not going to go into that now. Let's go back to the track record of why we, on which we did not decide to use 23andMe. Okay, so we have the breach, 6.9 million people affected. But that's not all. This is how data like got out illegally, but there's also data that got out of there legally, because selling genome kits to consumers isn't really that much of the business model, or at least it's not all of it. This is a nice quote from one of the board members from 2013. The long game here is not to make money selling kits, although the kits are essential to get the base level data. Once you have the data, the company does actually become the Google of personalized healthcare. The company has lowered the price of the kit again and again, most recently from $299 to a mere $99. Yeah, well, great. That means my data probably did not only get compromised through the breach, but also because their business model fundamentally evolves around actually just aggregating data and selling it to others. Also, like on a side note here, the kits here are priced with $299 to $99. That is incredibly low. That is, we did sequencing at a research lab at the university, and they were really nice and just said, like, just cover the ingredients. And just for like the ingredients, for like what's called the kits, we already paid around €600 per person. So that's just the ingredients. That's not the lab that you also need to run. That's not the labor that people put into it. That's not the storage of the data or the people who like do the analysis of that data. So just financially, this is not sustainable for this kind of business model where you just sequence people's DNA and then analyze it. Also, I actually didn't tell you, I said this was the biggest company. Well, they were kind of, because they're bankrupt. In October 2024, they filed for bankruptcy, which now exposes potentially 14 million people's data to what comes after a bankruptcy. There is a nice quote I found from the CEO said, "We are committed to customer privacy according to our current privacy policy." Well, let's have a look what the privacy policy says. It says, "If we are involved in a bankruptcy, merger, acquisition, reorganization, or sale of assets, your personal information may be accessed, sold, or transferred." So they are still committed to like the current privacy policy, but it was shit before, and it is still shit now. And so I just think, I'm just looking at this, and like, why? Like, just if you want to do a company this way, like, at least, I'm sorry, I just look at this and I'm thinking, like, this cannot be kind of the industry that I want to go into. Like, it has to be done better somehow, right? Like, the bar is on the floor, but I still want to get over it, you know? So, what I want you to take away from this, not just kind of what certain seemingly the industry standard might be, but also I think what we also can learn from this is what happens if you store a lot of data centrally in one place. In German, there's a nice way to talk about this. It's called ein Datenschatz, so like a data treasure or like a data hoard, where someone hoards all of your data. And alone from this fact, trouble arises. Because what happens if you have a lot of that in one place? A lot of people want access to it, be it legally through other companies who are interested in that data and would like to trade with you, be it illegally with malicious actors who will attack and try to breach. And so I think from this I would take away that the future of genomics should really be decentralized, with people having their own data in their own hands. And so, yeah, coming together on the financial part of privacy. We did this with university funding, and we did this in a not-for-profit environment. If someone here works at a lab where you do like sequencing commercially, please come to me and tell me kind of how the business side of that works, because I really would like to know, because kind of the role models I have are really bad. And I do acknowledge that, of course, if you want to make sequencing work and also want to make sequencing work for people, it also has to be kind of, it has to work commercially somehow. But yeah. So in our summer school, after it was done, we deleted all of the genomic data that we had, and we gave people their own genome on like an encrypted hard drive. We call that a genome take-home. I don't have that for you today, but I hope I can still give you something to take home with. First, genomes are computationally constructed. That's what we saw in the first technical part. Which genes are seen as normal is highly normative. And from both of these results, that if we want to sequence our own genome and get information about it and seek self-knowledge in that process, privacy has no price if we value empowerment. So, thank you very much. That has been it. Thanks for your attention.
And a big thanks to you, Polaris, for this very interesting talk with so many insights. I'm pretty sure we have a lot of questions here in the audience. Please raise your hand if you have one and try to reduce to just having one question and comments taken afterwards. I think the first one was here in the front.
Hi, so in Germany, I think we have a lot of laws already for genomes like GenDG and so on. So yes. Companies like 23andMe aren't allowed in Germany, as far as I know. So do you think policy makers are still missing some parts to regulate in Germany?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't really know the business side of this. Like, the thing that we operated in was in a university environment. And so like we used kind of the laws that apply to freedom of research and freedom of teaching at universities to kind of balance out our cause of why we actually want to do this. I think actually like the protections that we had to fulfill, the data privacy concept that we had to make, I think that was quite reasonable for what we're doing. But yeah, as I'm not doing this commercially, it's hard for me to comment on that.
The next question is right next to it, also in the back.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for the talk. I was wondering, is because you said this is all algorithmically constructed,
yes.
Is it like accurate enough to actually get the full genome as one file, as you would say? And if so, how much would it cost to get this done for yourself if you like look at commercially labs? Because as you said, $600 just for the materials is a lot already.
Okay, so it's kind of two questions. I'll try to separate it out technically. So what we did was not the whole genome. The whole genome is even more expensive than what we paid, but we used a sequencing technique called whole exome sequencing, where you just look at the genetically coding parts. And so, we only just got that. You can find genes, especially like if there's a lot of reference data for that. So there's stuff like, I don't know, actin filaments in your muscles. There's so much research about like muscle performance, also like in an athletic environment. So you get a lot of reference for that. For more rare genes or like stuff that's not as well researched, just because the reference is not there, it's going to be harder to find stuff. Secondly, what that would cost realistically, definitely the 600 euros for the exome sequencing, for the kits. Oh, I think the people who sequenced this for us, it took about a week, so you should price in like a week of labor costs, and then add X amount for laboratory upkeep, kind of the Yeah. If someone is here who works in a lab, please come to us afterwards. Maybe we would like to know.
Next question in the back.
So as a recovering 23andMe customer, you can log in and you can delete your data. But more importantly, one of the things that we do for security is we poison the data stream. If we have to do drug tests, like in America, that's common sometimes, we go and we buy fake urine and we submit this and we can win. Where is the business or opportunity to buy fake genome to be sequenced to poison the signal supply so that it is too noisy? Like, if these companies are going to use and capitalize on this, let us over-normalize the data stream so that they cannot gain information from it.
So is it...
I guess the question is, is that a thing that your group has considered? Or like an opportunity of like, can we apply masking so that like, if you want to have just this particular sequence, a portion of your genome sequenced, but not the rest of your data collected, mm-hmm. like, can I apply like a bit mask sort of concept to this? If you do use commercial companies for this.
I think that's a question for someone who does biotech. I have not really stood in a laboratory, except when I went to give my spit samples for the sequencing. That does sound hard, though. I gotta admit. But so, my group, we just try to make this work somehow. Get it genome sequencing accessible. It was not as offensive, though I like your style of thinking on this.
Yeah, and please remember to phrase your question as a question. If you want to continue the discussion, you can always find each other after the Q&A here. And the next question we have on the right side.
Thank you for the talk. I have a question about the analysis of genomic data after it has been sequenced. So you said that you can look if you have, for example, a specific mutation, but what if you don't know what you're looking for? What does the infrastructure look for this? For example, if you want to check some, these polygenomic trait scores or stuff, is that something that you can do at home as long as you have a copy of your genomic data? Like, go looking without necessarily knowing what you're looking for?
I would say you could do that at home. A lot of bioinformatics, the academic culture in it, is very open source. So there's a lot of open data as reference material. You should just maybe keep in mind that we use something called the reference genome to kind of compare our genomic data to. The reference genome, it's not quotes, it's just the reference genome, was based on 10 people in the 1990s in the Human Genome Project. And we don't know the identities of these people. But it has happened in the US, and so it's probably more centric to that demography. And I don't know, if you're not a cis white man, you might kind of differ from that, and you have to keep that in mind that you might not find certain things because that's not the reference that they use. I mean, I kind of oversimplified here. It's not just the 10 people in the reference genome. It has since been updated over and over again, but this is kind of the stock where it started from.
We had a question here in the front, but I think the person is gone. Yeah. Maybe we have some other questions. We still have time. Please raise your hand. Otherwise, Signal Angel, do we have some question from the internet? Okay, we have one here in the middle.
How much storage space do you usually need for the genome of a single person?
So I think not that much, to be honest. A couple of gigabytes will be enough for exome sequencing, what we did. But that's kind of the final result after all of the computation has run to kind of put it together. The reads will be bigger. I think we were at around 10 gigabytes or a bit more for the raw data. Yeah. Yeah. Here in the front, someone says it would be tenfold of that for the whole genome.
The next question we have here.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. And you mentioned you organized this summer school to sequence like your genome. Are you aware if there's like other similar programs where you could just go to and try it out?
I mean, I hope we can do it again. So you could maybe attend another one of our programs. I mean, I've been in touch with people from New York that did it for like an anthropological genome course. But yeah, I feel like we might be different than that because we're very focused on like privacy and like not holding onto the data afterwards.
In the middle, there was a question here.
Okay, you said we should all have our genomes on our hard drives at home. How do we do research?
That's a really good question. I am really interested, if there's any cryptographers around, if we can talk to each other, how we can work on encrypted genomes. And also, this is like very science fiction. This is very far away from what kind of research is right now. And also how we could kind of do decentralized like genome analysis structures where we do it over a network so people can hold on to their own data, but still, if they consent to it, we could use like a decentralized protocol to do research on that. But yeah, that's really science fiction-y, so if you want to build that, come to me. Let's think about how we can get there in 10 years.
We still have some time. Do we have more questions? I don't see any hands. And also the internet is pretty satisfied with the answers. Maybe we just finish here and give a big applause to Polaris. (Clears throat)